Today's Taisho will be on case 23 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 23 is entitled, Think Neither Good Nor Evil. The sixth patriarch was pursued by the monk Myo as far as Taiyu Mountain. The patriarch, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, this robe represents the Dharma. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now. Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please give me your instruction. The patriarch said, think neither good nor evil. At this very moment, what is the original self of the monk Myo? At these words, Myo was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and bowed, saying, besides the secret words and secret meaning you have just now revealed to me, is there anything else deeper still? The patriarch said, what I have told you is no secret at all. When you look into your own true self, whatever is deeper is found right there. Myo said, I was with the monks under Obai for many years but could not realize my true self. But now receiving your instruction, I know it is like a person drinking water and knowing whether it is cold or warm. My lay brother, you are now my teacher. The patriarch said, if you say so, that's fine, but let's both call Obai our teacher. Be mindful to treasure and hold fast what you have attained. Mumon's comment, the sixth patriarch was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed grandmotherly kindness. It is as though he peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Mumon's verse, you cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So the story behind this koan is necessary to know. The fifth founder, it says patriarch. I have to go through this book and cross out everywhere it says patriarch. I'm like, founder. So I don't keep saying patriarch. But it's been translated into English as patriarch, but a better translation would mean something like founder. The Zen tradition was brought to China by an Indian monk named Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma really existed. There really was a Bodhidharma, and he really did come to China. And he really was a master of what became Zen, a great meditation master. And his writings are actually around. People have his writings. He came to China to bring a particular meditative school, which has become known as Chan or Zen. And he had quite a reputation in India as a great meditation master. So when he got to China, they set up an interview with the emperor. So Bodhidharma went to meet the emperor, and the emperor was deeply interested in Buddhism, and he was quite wealthy, of course, being the emperor of China, and he was building temples for people and libraries and what would be the equivalent of Buddhist universities. So Bodhidharma's meeting with the emperor was a great opportunity for his Zen school, for his Zen tradition. And if everything had gone well, Bodhidharma would have introduced himself to the emperor, and the emperor would have gone, "Wow, this Zen sounds great. You know, let me build you a nice big temple." You know, but the interview went very badly, and the emperor didn't understand what Bodhidharma was talking about. And he said, "What do you do in the Zen school?" And he said, "We cultivate vast emptiness." And the emperor didn't understand that at all, and they couldn't really communicate. The communication broke down. And Bodhidharma left. And then he went up into the mountains in the area of what is now known as Shaolin Temple. And this area that where he went is even today rather remote and poor, a province of China, not wealthy and powerful. And still, even with all the modernization that's going on in China, this is one of the poorer provinces. So Bodhidharma went and lived in a cave, and people in the area knew that there was a holy man living in this cave, and they brought him food. And he did zazen every day. He sat facing the wall of the cave and just did zazen. Now, if you have come to China to bring your tradition, this would seem like an unlikely way to do it, right? I mean, most people would think the way to do it is to interest the emperor. And if you can't interest the emperor, maybe Bodhidharma should be going and interviewing, or going on interviews with other rich and powerful Chinese people. But he didn't do that. He just went up into the mountains and he practiced zazen. He did zazen for 9 years. And one day, a man showed up and became his first student. And a woman showed up and another man. So he had really three students. Now, after his student died, his oldest student became the sort of the head of the lineage. And then after he died, somebody became the head of a lineage. And then down to the number five, who's called Obai here in Japanese. Obai is the fifth person, the fourth person from Bodhidharma. Okay? So it's like a passing on this lineage, as it's called. And then the sixth person in this lineage was this man named Wei Nang. And Wei Nang was an illiterate woodcutter, and he went to the temple of Obai. By this time, Zen had become, it started out as a guy sitting in a cave, staring at the wall of the cave, but it had become well-known and respected, and Obai had many, many students training under him, and he had a nice temple and so on. And this illiterate woodcutter came and practiced in the monastery, but not as a monk. He worked in the kitchen, cooking rice and doing other chores, bringing firewood. But he had a deep awakening experience, and when Obai was dying, he decided to pass on his authority, if you want to put it that way, his seal of enlightenment, to Wei Nang. This upset all the monks in the temple, because basically they had been doing zazen for 20 years. And they had been going through koan training and all this other stuff. And this little pipsqueak had come to the temple, and he was working in the kitchen, and he was chopping firewood. And he wasn't even a monk, and now Obai was going to give him the robe and the bowl, the begging bowl, that had been brought to China from India by Bodhidharma. I hope this is making some sense. So The monks were furious at Obai for giving the transmission to this outsider. And they were furious at Obai also for not honoring their many years of hard work. And it seemed totally unfair to them that this guy, who wasn't even a monk, would be receiving Dharma transmission, and they were being passed over. So basically, when Obai called Wei Neng into to his room, before he had announced publicly his decision, he said, "Listen, I'm going to make you my Dharma heir, but if I do, everybody is going to be pissed off at you, and they might even beat you up or kill you. I don't know what's going to happen. So I want you to take this robe and I want you to take this bowl and just get out of here, okay? You've got my seal of approval, you're deeply awake, now go carry on the Zen tradition, but don't do it here because basically these people really hate your guts, you know." So Wei Neng left with the robe and the bowl, and he went on many wanderings, and he eventually settled down and started teaching. In the meantime, one of the monks at the temple, at Obai's temple, was an ex-general. He was like a military man. And after Obai went public and said, "I've given my Dharma transmission to Wei Neng, and he's gone," the monks were furious, and they were all talking. And the general said, "You know, what? He gave Wei Neng the robe and the bowl? That's outrageous! You know, that's outrageous!" And he said, "I'm going to track. He must have stolen it. He must have pulled the wool over old Obai. You know, he's old. He's senile. His judgment is bad. He probably deceived Obai somehow. And then he took the robe and the bowl. I'm going to get him back." So he was a military man. So he was like a good tracker, right? You know, he could pursue the enemy. And so he left the monastery and he tracked down Wei Neng. And Wei Neng had set the roll and the bowl on a rock. And so Wei Neng is like washing his face in the water by a little pond. And the general sees him and he comes down and he's about to grab the bowl and the robe, but he can't lift them up. He can't pick them up. And he's thinking, "What the hell?" You know, has like a enlightenment experience right there, and he has it when he and Wei Neng have a little exchange of words. He can't pick up the robe and the bowl, and Wei Neng says to him, "Look, are you interested in the robe and the bowl, or are you interested in enlightenment? You know, you've become fixated on these symbols of authority." And when the general hears those words, basically, he has like an enlightening experience. And then he starts crying and he says, "This is amazing. I had no idea that enlightenment was like this. Do you have any other secret teachings you'd like to give me?" And Wei Neng says, "There aren't any secret teachings. It's right there all the time." So that's basically the koan, and the advice that triggers the words that trigger the actual kensho enlightenment experience is think neither good nor evil. Think neither good nor evil. So this koan is about thinking neither good nor evil. Okay, so this is really like a very 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 important koan. And when we say good and evil, we might be thinking just simply about morals or ethics. But this koan is really much deeper than that. It's very important. When I came here to New Jersey, I went to study with a teacher who was a Dharma brother of my first teacher. His name is Edo Roshi. My teacher Genki Roshi and Edo Roshi knew each other in Japan. They went to the same university. And they trained with some of the same teachers in the same lineage. And Edo Roshi came to the United States and in the 60s, and he had a little zendo in his apartment in New York. And it was not a very nice apartment, but he was holding zazen. And who should hear, anyway, word got around New York that there was this Japanese master holding zazen. And two people came in to do zazen with Edo Roshi, a man named Chester Carlson and his wife. And it turns out that Chester Carlson was the president of the 3M Corporation. Maybe you've heard of them, but they used to make recording tape, and they have they manufacture many different products. But they, at the time, they were one of the biggest. 3M was one of the biggest companies in the United States. So they were very impressed with Edo Roshi, and they basically bought him a monastery. And it's up in the central New York State. It's up in the Catskills. And if you want to go there, it's about 3 hours from here. And you have to drive up north, and you turn off this road, and you get to this little hick town. And then you go through the hick town and you keep going, and it's just farms and forests. And then there's a little sign that says Daibo Satsu Zendo, and you turn off the road and then you drive for miles on their own property. They have 1,400 acres. Yeah. So you have to actually drive, and you drive, and they own like the mountain that the temple is on. And when you come, when you drive in, you drive and you drive and you drive and you drive and you drive, and it's beautiful. It's country road, you know, ferns and trees. And you eventually come to the temple, and the temple is a Japanese style building, very beautiful, on a lake, on a mountain lake, you know. And it's just beautiful, right? And it's so quiet. Just all you hear is the wind and the birds, and sometimes there's a loon, you know, beautiful loon in the water. So peaceful, so beautiful. And people go. They have a zendo in New York as well. It's down in Manhattan, and it's in a very nice part of Manhattan. So Chester Carlson must have bought him a place in Manhattan too. And anyway, a lot of people from the city go up there, and they do sesshin up there at Daibo Satsu, and it's like a wonderland. It's so beautiful, it's so peaceful, and it's so still. And people who are from New York, where it's so noisy all the time, hectic, you know, they go up there and they can sort of like soak in the quiet and the stillness. See? And this is quite beautiful as an experience, you know. But it's not necessarily Zen. See, it's not necessarily Zen. There's something wrong, in my opinion. If somebody wants to give me 1,400 acres, I'll take it, you know. But nevertheless, that's not necessarily the best training environment, see. It's not. I'm telling you the truth, you know. Because Zen is not about going up to a quiet place and grooving. We used to say grooving on the stillness. Zen is not about stillness. It's not about silence. It's not actually about listening to the wind. See, it's not. That's a mistake. See, what happens to all those people is they go up there and they do sesshin and they sit around and they listen to the loons calling, right? And then when the sesshin is over, they get in their car and they drive back to the city, and it's beep, 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 you know, and get out of my way, you know, blah, blah, blah. Jackhammers. And they think, God damn, I'm back in this crap. See, I'm back in this noisy hellhole. See? So, you know, actually, the world is like cut in two for these people. It's like the beautiful stillness of Sesshin and then the noisy hell realm of everyday life. This is like, and this split is produced by practicing in the wrong way. It's produced by practicing in the wrong way. See, many people think, you know, if you read stories about Zen, you know, the great Zen temples were all up in the mountains, you know, and they were remote from the cities, you know, there's pictures of these beautiful temples in these faraway mountains, like enchanted temples in enchanted mountains. And monks lived up there, and there's paintings from old antiquity of monks in the middle of a deep forest, you know, looking around at monks. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. But that was the 7th century, and this is now. The unfolding of the universe is not the same from moment to moment. You know, you can't be a 7th century monk. That you have to be 20th century Zen practitioner, 21st century Zen practitioner. And this is very important. You can't, a 7th century monk can't help anybody, really. What we need are enlightened people in the 21st century reality. This is very, very important. You know, looking backward at the past and longing for the past is unhealthy, and it's not truthful. What the world needs are enlightened people in this moment, right? In this moment, this world now needs enlightened people very desperately, and you can't help if you're imitating 7th century Zen master in the deep forest of China. That's a kind of a false, that's a mental image people have created that's false. It's imaginary. So my feeling is that Zen is not about going up into the distant mountains and dwelling among the clouds, even though there's nothing wrong with that, as I'm saying. If you happen to be there, please enjoy them. And I myself like to hike. But Zen is a deeper mind than the mind that says, this is peaceful and this is noisy. See? Zen, if you're making that distinction, you're not practicing Zen. You're practicing something else. And if you go to Zen retreats and you cling to the stillness and the sound of the wind and the peacefulness, you're going to create a split in your world, which is the very opposite of enlightened mind. So, you know, here we're practicing next to State Route 99. So we're not up in the mountains, and it gets a lot of traffic. And indeed, a block from here, they're doing construction, you know, and you can hear the construction. And you know what it's going to be? It's going to be a Walmart, you know. So I don't know how long Murray Grove will be in business. And if you said to somebody, yes, you met somebody from Ado Roshi's group, you know, he could say, yes, we were all up at Daibosatsu listening to the loon. And you can say, oh, that's great, we practice Zen too. And you say, where do you practice? Oh, next to the Walmart. But I actually think that's a wonderful, a wonderful opportunity, see, to practice very deeply. Really wonderful opportunity. See, if you come to Sesshin and you think, I'm going to sit on my cushion, and I'm going to enter samadhi, and I'm going to be, my mind is going to be still, and everything about me is so still, right, and so quiet. I'm going to hear the wind blowing through the trees. You know, that is indeed beautiful. But what happens if you're sitting there and you're thinking, okay, I'm entering samadhi, I can hear the wind, and now I'm going to enjoy the stillness. And then, beep, 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 beep,
boom,
beep, beep. You think, God damn it, my beautiful stillness is gone. See, what? This is no good. See, this is no good. Now your world's been cut in two. This is very important. Zen is not about being in the imaginary 7th century world. It's about being in this world. Which one? The one we're in right now. Always. Always. See? So basically, if you're practicing Zen desperately seeking stillness, you're actually it's like creating a kind of mental illness. Really, it's like a mental illness, because of course it's never really still, it's never really quiet enough, and you know, I mean, we could practice Zen like in a soundproof chamber, right? We could say, well, it's got to be soundproof, right? And so we look for places no sound, you know, and we could, you know, we could have like white noise machines going. I actually use one at the university, and I use one at the university because most of the people who come to sit are beginners, right? And so I don't want them to. It's difficult for beginners to do this, but when you're a more advanced practitioner, you know, great meditation masters will say the same thing. You know, you should be able to meditate next to a busy street, you know. And people think, sure, someday. But right now I want the stillness. But actually, you can't achieve that much with the stillness, you know. I mean, if you were to go to a temple in China in the 7th century, or a temple in Japan at the end of the 21st century, you might go to a beautiful valley and there's a temple there. And then you think, okay, oh, stillness, peace, you know. And you go in and you sit down, and you get on your cushion, and you think, now I'm going to meditate. But then you realize, wait a minute, what's the temperature in here, right? Because they don't heat the temple, right? They don't heat a zendo. That's like a joke, right? So if it's 25 degrees out there, it's 25 degrees in the zendo. That's how it is. And so, I don't know if you've ever done that kind of sitting, but I have. It's really difficult, you know, because you can sit down on the cushion and you can start focusing, you can work with your hara, you squeeze the hara, you squeeze your abdomen, the breath goes out, your mind becomes blank, and you have a little peace for a second, right? But as soon as you come back into your body, what do you notice? You're freezing your ass off, right? And then you do it again. And cold is very, very difficult to deal with. It's like it's painful, right? And it's inescapable, right? It's inescapable. So it's naive to think that the people in the 7th century were in this very beautiful, insulated environment, right? They didn't have street noise, but what they did have was piercing cold. And that's the best darn thing in the world, because, again, It cuts your world in two. You know, you say, I'm going to sit on the cushion, I'm going to go into deep samadhi, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, this is really cold, right? And then you go back into samadhi. Same situation. It's frustrating to have your dreams smashed in that way, you know. To have your dreams of peace and stillness smashed. And cold is especially insidious, you know, because in a Japanese temple, you know, basically it's like you're not warm all day long, right, in the winter. It's like people will tell you, you know, you don't get warm all day long. The one time you're warm is when you take a bath. The Japanese like to take baths, so they take a hot bath, and that's it. You're warm, and you're never warm for the rest of the day. And you're not warm in your room when you go to bed at night. And this sounds terribly cruel, but what it forces people to do is go to a deeper level of concentration, deeper level of samadhi. And it's the same right here. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you think, ah, now for the stillness, now for the peace, and all of a sudden, beep 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 beep. You think, oh damn it, you know, where's my stillness? But you've got to drop down into deeper mind, into a deeper mind. You know, when something bothers you, if you look carefully, you'll see there's the event, and then there's right after the event, there's your response to it, right? So, you know, basically, you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, now for the peace, and then beep, beep. And by the way, that beeping sound is made to be annoying, you know, it's made. People actually did tests to see what would be the most piercing and annoying sound, right? Because it's supposed to alert people if something is backing up. So basically, it can't be too mellow a sound or people will screen it out. So they wanted it to be something you couldn't screen out. So it's very annoying, right? And insistent. So you sit on the cushion and, you know, basically you hear this sound and you have the response probably that most people would have, which is, that breaks my concentration, that breaks my mental stillness, right? So you hear the sound and then you have like a response, a conditioned response. And it's usually like revulsion. You could describe it as like recoiling or revulsion, right? Now, as soon as you see that revulsion response in yourself, you know your mind is not you're not in the unified mind in accord with the way. This is true for every experience you have. As soon as that sense of recoiling or pulling away or revolting or agitation, as soon as those things arise, please understand the problem is not in the sensory input. It's not in the event, it's in your mental attitude towards the event. This is so crucial. This is incredibly important. So your mental response is the problem, not the event. That's the truth. So what you have to do, the only way to solve the problem, short of like leaving, and that won't solve it either, because, you know, when you get home, it's going to be something else frustrating you. So basically, short of finding like a soundproof room or a trouble-proof world, right, which fortunately doesn't exist, basically what you've got to do is get to this deeper mind. So this is like perfect training, right? Being irritated in this way is you need to be able to respond to the event with a mind as placid as a windless pond. And you can do it. You can do it. You will do it, you know. Just keep going. So what happens is, you know, if something bothers you, you just go back to your breath, right? You squeeze your abdomen, you follow the breath out, and at the end of your breath, your mind is blank, right? And then you're going to be aware of your surroundings, probably, or whatever is bothering you. It might be your something going on in your head. But whatever is bothering you, you're going to become aware of it again. And you go, you follow the breath out and you go back to the blankness. Eventually, you know, you're going to stop having like agitation or revulsion or recoiling type reactions. And your mind's going to become very serene and still. And in fact, your concentration will be very deep, very deep. You know, this is like perfect. This is how it's done, right? I mean, in some ways, having annoying circumstances like very cold room or a noisy environment is perfect. Because, many people have a hard time getting out of their thoughts, right? I mean, you know, when you sit on the cushion, you're working with your koan, but a lot of the time is just BS, right? You know, it's comfortable, it's beautiful, maybe it is very peaceful and still. You can just lose yourself in daydreams and so on. When it's somewhat uncomfortable, then you kind of have to do the work. You have to do the work. And that's the best situation in the world. I mean, Zen masters in Japan and China used cold very skillfully to force people to enter a non-unified mind in accord with the way. And when you're freezing cold, there's nothing you can do about it except get out of your small self. But other irritants are just as effective. So what you need to do if something is bothering you is to cultivate this deep mind, you know, and just remind yourself that it's not the event that's the problem. It's your habitual response. And in other words, it's karma. So what you need to do is clear away your karma by going deeply into mushin. And eventually what will happen is you will find you have an imperturbable mind. You do. You have an imperturbable mind. It's imperturbable. And when you find it, it's so wonderful. You know? And then something else perturbs you and you go back and try again. But you have an imperturbable mind if you just keep practicing. And when you're there, it's like sitting in the you know, the whole world can be going crazy around you, but your mind is as still as a pond with no wind and a lake with no wind. The noisier it gets outside, the quieter you get inside. This is how it has to be. So the noisier it gets outside, please, and this becomes a, you'll be able to do this very easily after a while. The noisier it gets outside, the more still your mind has to be. See, the more quiet your mind has to be. You'll find this imperturbable mind, which is like so important. Right? This is what the general, right, discovered when he encountered Wei Neng over the robe and the bowl. The imperturbable mind. It's not the experience. It's not the object. If you're clinging to form, you can't be liberated. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, there's a line where the Buddha says, "He who seeks me through signs, basically, he who seeks me through forms, or seeks me through sound, is going in the wrong direction." See, this is very crucial. In other words, you know, the most beautiful sounds in the world can't liberate you. They can't. And the most beautiful setting, you know, when you look out the window and you see beautiful trees and stuff, that isn't going to liberate you. The Buddha said that. Many people have that kind of spirituality, right? You go seeking beautiful vistas. I myself like them. I go hiking, you know, I look out and I say, "Oh, a beautiful mountainside, how beautiful," right? And I feel happy and so on. But this is not a deepest mind. This is a discriminating mind, let's face it. If I go to a museum, I'll see a painting and think, "Oh, exquisite." And then I'll go, "Well, this one's not nearly as good, see." And now that's a discriminate, that's not Buddha mind, that's a small mind. I'm just playing around in the small mind. But this is about the imperturbable, unified mind in accord with the way. A unified mind doesn't pick and choose. It doesn't say, "Well, I'll unify with this and I won't unify with that." It doesn't say this is a natural sound and this is an unnatural sound. That's not the unified mind in accord with the way. That's your small mind talking. So the desire to practice Zen as it was practiced in the 7th century on a distant mountaintop, see, is a very self-deluding desire. It's very important to practice Zen in the world as it is right now, because the universe is unfolding and we have to be one with it. That doesn't mean we buy our clothes at Walmart, right? Since Walmart doesn't support Barack Obama, I'm not going to support Walmart. Okay? And it doesn't mean I wouldn't sign a petition opposing a Walmart, right, down the street. I certainly would. But you know, Zen is about being unified with the moment as it unfolds in finding this imperturbable mind. This does exist. If it doesn't exist, we're wasting our time here. This is all a fraud. If Zen is about going up to a mountain where it's quiet and listening to the wind, it's a fraud. See? It is. I mean, not that if you have 1,400 acres, you want to give them to me, I'll take them. Okay? But it's still a fraud. I'm not saying Eido Roshi's a fraud. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is clinging to beautiful mountain lake, clinging to the sound of loons, clinging to the sound of the wind, this is just what the Buddha said in the Diamond Sutra you mustn't do if you want to wake up. He who seeks me through form, he who seeks me in sound is going in the wrong direction. How do you wake up? Mushin, blank mind. And when something annoys you, you go deeper into blank mind. And there's going to be like a feeling of pressure, right? You go into blank mind and then there it is again, beep, 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 and you go into blank mind. Or it could be pain in your legs, right? Pain too is very annoying, right? And you think, I don't want to be in this moment. I want a moment where there's no pain. But you know, basically, if we were all sitting on super comfortable cushions, you know, and so on, then again, this would be like a fraud, right? I mean, this is not about it's not about picking and choosing. It's about you being one with the universe as it unfolds right here in Lenoka Harbor, New Jersey, on the 22nd. Of October 2008, next to the Walmart construction, and if that is Zen, if that's not, if people can't practice Zen in that setting, then it's all fraud. Then all of our talk about a unified mind is just bullshit. We don't really want to unify, right? We want to unify with what's nice, and we want to avoid what's not nice. But that's not Buddhism. Somebody came to Sesshin came to Sesshin and had to leave. And I was sorry that the person had to leave. And the person said to me, you know, I have these personal circumstances that require me to leave. And I was sorry I didn't see the person go, you know. And the person said to me, but, you know, I would like to have Dokusan. Could we have Dokusan on, like, after a Saturday sit? And at first I said yes. I said, sure. And then I came in and sat down on my cushion, and I realized I had given the wrong answer. So as the person was leaving, I went back and I said, I have to tell you, I can't do Dokusan with you. I do Dokusan at Sesshin. Because, you can have a practice. You can have a practice. You can meditate once a week or twice a week, but it's not Zen practice. Right? It's not Zen. It's a practice, but it's not Zen. Zen practice is Sesshin. Zen practice is Sesshin. This is why I don't do Dokusan on, like, you know, on Wednesday night or something like that. Because that's not Zen. It's a practice, but it's not Zen. The way of Zen is Sesshin. And the way of Zen is a unified mind in accord with the way. So what we're doing is a really wonderful opportunity to wake up. I hope you don't think I was unkind to that person, but it's so important to understand that this is the path, right? You know, if you're, you know, people say to me, I didn't have a good sleep because I didn't get enough sleep, or blah blah blah. You know, that's not the path. You know, you could be, you know, when you're tired, you become one with the reality at that moment. You know, and when you're in pain, you have pain in your legs, you become one with the, and this can't be achieved in an hour, right? We're going to sit 8 or 9 hours today, and we're going to unify. And the mind's going to become very deep and clear. And still, even if everything around us is like crazy, right? And you do that for 5 days, and you have like this beautiful mind. And the universe is, there are no obstacles in any direction. That's the goal. It doesn't say a perfect world. It says, in this world, there's no obstacles in any direction. In my opinion, it requires some work. So everybody's doing a wonderful job. You're here at Sesshin, and the universe is unfolding as it is unfold, as it has to unfold. Everything is happening just as it has to happen. Cannot be different from this. That's an unhealthy mind that says, this is not the universe I want. Everything's unfolding as it has to unfold. And the choices are how we wish to respond to these events. Angry, disappointed, bitter, frustrated. You can treat reality as a piece of chalk screeching across the blackboard, right? Or you can deal with things that frustrate you by going deep into blank mind, deep into mungshin. And then, see, everything is, you know, I'll stop in just a minute, but Lin Ji used to use this story. He said that the man of Zen, or the woman of Zen, is like, in Chinese mythology, there's something called a hamsa. And a hamsa is a goose. It's a magical goose. And the hamsa has a special power, and it's like this: I have a bowl of milk, see, and I take some poison and I put the poison in the bowl of milk, see, and the hamsa is able to go down into the milk, see, and put its beak in the milk and drink just the milk and leave the poison in the bowl, see. I love that, because that's what Zen is like, see. That poison and milk are all mixed together in this world. Another way to put it is we can transform the poison into milk. You know, we can drink just the milk. So even in an unhealthy world, we can be healthy. Even in an unhealthy world, we can be, even in an unnatural world, we can be natural. See, this is Zen. Be like the Hamsa. You could be sitting in the midst of a madhouse and be as calm and happy and kindly and compassionate as if you were on a paradise, if you were on Kauai, right? In fact, much more so. Not much can be achieved in Kauai, but a great deal can be achieved here today. So please understand that this is a great opportunity to unify your mind, and that the challenges that life presents to you here and off the cushion in your life are like rice if you have the right mindset. And the key is mushin. The key is mushin. Just now I saw somebody sitting and I looked and I saw that person's hara going in and out, in and out, in and out. And I thought, great! Wonderful practice. See, really, that was marvelous. I was just thrilled to see that. So just keep going. You're doing a wonderful job.